Now 61, Kenosha and Racine, 55 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg, up next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Any of you who were alive in 1984 and watching the Olympic Games in 1984 will surely remember one of the most dramatic moments from those games. Games which, to such a large extent, were feel-good games for American viewers. So many American athletes did superbly well on the track, in the diving pool, in the swimming pool, in various events, in the gymnastics events as well. One place in which things went drastically wrong for the Americans came in one of the longest races to be won by the women, in which a very unfortunate collision occurred between the favorite in that race, Mary Decker, and a diminutive runner from South Africa named Zola Budd. And the story, not only of that sort of catastrophe in that particular race, but of the backstory leading up to it and the aftermath of it, is told in an amazing book called Olympic Collision, The Story of Mary Decker and Zola Budd. It's published by the University of Nebraska Press, and the author is Kyle Keiterling, who has written a number of different books before, including Heart of a Lion, The Life, Death, and Legacy of Hank Gathers, who, of course, was a very, very gifted basketball player. Again, this particular book is called Olympic Collision. And Kyle Keiterling, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. Good to be with you.
So, it's no surprise that someone would want to write a book about this dramatic moment in Olympic history in the 3,000-meter race at the 84 Olympic Games. In some ways, the biggest surprise is that there hasn't been a full-length book devoted to it before this, or at least I'm not aware of any book. Did anything in particular prompt you to want to take the time to explore this story in such careful detail?
Well, I like everyone that was old enough to watch the Olympics in 1984, I remember the event. It made quite an impression, and I was, like everyone else in the United States at the time, a very big fan of our greatest middle-distance runner ever, Mary Decker, and I thought perhaps I knew the whole story, but I didn't really know the story of Zola Budd, and as it turned out, I really didn't know much of anything about Mary Decker, which became apparent when I started to do the interviews. This race was ballyhooed as the premier event of the Olympic Games. ABC had the rights. It was viewed, Greg, by 2 billion people around the world. And leading up to this event, all you could hear was that there's going to be this great duel in the Coliseum between America's sweetheart, Mary Decker, and Zola Butt, a very controversial, just barely 18-year-old, 5 foot, 84-pound barefoot runner who had come from South Africa, which was an outcast among the family of nations. They couldn't compete in the Olympics, but she had been brought to Great Britain in March of 1984 by a tabloid newspaper over there that paid her father £100,000, British pounds, for the, if you can believe this, life story to the life of a 17-year-old girl. And so everybody was looking forward to this, and the other thing that made it interesting was that Mary Decker had a soap opera-like life and career. She had started out in Southern California as an 11-year-old. By the time she was 14, she had the fastest 1500-meter time in the United States, but she was too young at 14 to be a member of the Olympic team in 1972. In 1976, she was hurt. In 1980, we had the Carter boycott of the Olympic Games. So here now, finally, after 12 years, is the 1984 Games, and lo and behold, they're being held in Southern California, and basically in her backyard, and she's the favorite in the race, at least in terms of what the press and the media described. In fact, there were there were other women in that race who probably should have been favored more than Mary, and certainly more than Zola, who had virtually no international experience at all. So the buildup was something. They had the Wheaties box ready for Mary Decker's picture, and then, of course, they ran the race.
Right. And, of course, many people will remember that dramatic moment when Mary Decker, running just behind Zola Budd, is tripped. Or trips, and sprawls to the infield, injuring her hip, unable to continue the race, sobbing uncontrollably. Zola Budd fades to seventh as boos rain down from the crowd, and it is just not anything like what most Americans, and certainly Mary Decker, had expected in terms of how that race would be run. Before we dig into some more details here, I want you to talk for a moment about all of the people that you spoke to in order to tell this whole story with such rich detail. And we should also point out that on that long list of people to whom you spoke, one of them was Zola Budd, one of them is not, however, Mary Decker.
Yeah, well, it's not for a lack of trying, but I did have an opportunity to talk to Mary's coaches. The very first coach she had, Don Danoon, who started with her when she was just 11-year-old kid in Southern California. Her subsequent coaches, Rich Castro, who had her at the University of Colorado, and then Dick Brown, who was the man that worked for Nike, whom Mary ran. Mary was the first woman athlete that Nike signed, and Dick Brown took over her coaching, and for the next four seasons leading up to the 1984 Games, she was just phenomenal. It was the first time really in her long career that she had been healthy and stayed healthy and was able to run. So I had a whole list of people that would talk to me, and including those who competed against Mary from the time she was a teenager, and others that ran against her in the elite international competition. Mary Decker had a soap opera like life and career, and one of the things, Greg, that I think readers will find interesting in this story is that, despite the fact that these two women, Zola Budd and Mary Decker, were born 8 years and 8,000 miles apart, they led very similar lives, and they had very similar career paths, almost parallel, until they intersected in this collision in the 1984 Olympic Games. Both of these women, both of them came from dysfunctional families. Both were estranged from their fathers, which became a motivating factor in their ability to run and run as well as they did. And they both used this early trauma that they endured as motivation. Both were teenage phenoms in their respective countries. Both were two-time world champions, and both would eventually be banned from the sport by the international governing body, although for very different reasons. And neither one of these women, despite all their accomplishments through the years, ever achieved an Olympic medal of any kind. And the other thing that's interesting is that both of these women employed the same style of running. They always ran from the front, which many people will tell you in track is a suicidal strategy. You don't want to be the pace setter. You want to come from off the pace. But these women both ran from the front. They always had run from the front. And, of course, when you have two women that want to be first, something has got to give, and that's what happened in that race. But I think that people will find the stories of their lives as interesting as the background incident that they're known for and remembered for. You know, one of the saddest things about sports is here you have two spectacularly talented runners. Two-time world champions, both the greatest runners their country's ever produced. And here we are 32 years later, and we remember them for their most embarrassing moment.
Yeah, that just doesn't seem right, does it?
No, it does not.
One of the things that I think was probably quite tricky for you is that, in the acknowledgments at the front of the book, when you talk about the different people to whom you spoke and to whom you're very grateful, obviously, because there would have been no book without these many conversations, you thank Zola Budd vociferously for graciously speaking with you. And you say she remains and forever will be a champion in my mind for her willingness to relive for me some of the most difficult times any athlete ever faced anywhere. You clearly came to a very, very deep respect for and affection for Zola Budd. And, of course, in a sense, never had the opportunity to experience that with Mary Decker. Was it difficult, in a sense, to write this book fairly? That is, to not paint the one woman as the villain in this story. And I'm not saying that's what you do. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, there are some ways in which the portrait painted of Mary Decker is not as sympathetic as that of Zola Budd. And perhaps in your mind, that's inescapable. I'm more interested in how you wrestled with this dilemma as the author.
Well, I said before that the event was held in the Coliseum in Los Angeles, and it was billed as a duel in the Coliseum. And as you know, watching television and Western movies growing up, there's only room in a duel for two people. And we are able, because of Hollywood, to identify the villain and the hero because of the white hat and the black hat. Now, going into this race, the white hat was Mary Decker and the black hat was Zola Budd. And that's the prism of TV that formed our opinions of these two women. And that's what I carried into the story. And I think that's what most of your listeners probably remember. In the aftermath of the incident, Mary Decker, who never did return to the race after she fell to the infield, was carried off the track in the arms of her 300-pound discus-throwing fiancé while the cameras clicked away. And then he carried her again into the press conference to talk about the incident. And Mary proceeds to tell everyone that she blames Zola Budd. And Zola Budd, and this is a prevarication, by the way, that she continued to utter for 10 years before she finally changed her story and said it was not Zola Budd's fault. So we have these images in our collective minds that are formed through the prism of television coverage of the event, the aftermath of the event, and I was actually pretty surprised to find out what really went on and what the true stories were. And empathy for Zola Budd is very, very easy to arrive at. This young girl was 17 years old when she ran in a 5,000-meter race in Stellenbosch in South Africa in January of 1984. She broke the existing world record by 6 seconds, and that record was held by her idol, Mary Decker. Now, having done that, this tabloid newspaper, the Daily Mail in Great Britain, saw the results of the race. And as I said earlier, South Africa was not allowed to compete internationally at all. Their athletes were banned because of their apartheid policy of their government. So the Daily Mail goes to South Africa, and they make a deal with Zola Budd's father, who's another interesting character in the book. And for £100,000, he sells her rights to Great Britain, and they spirit her out of the country and take her to Great Britain so she can run for England in the Olympics. Well, she gets there, the headline in the newspaper on the day after she arrives is Zola Go Home. And from that point forward until the race in August of 1984 in the Olympics Games, Zola Budd becomes the most mistreated, misjudged, exploited young woman I think that there has ever been in the history of athletics. No one in my experience has ever been as savaged by the media and by a vocal, but a small but vocal anti-apartheid lobby in Great Britain the way this woman was treated.
Right. And to be clear, the part of the controversy was at least the perception that Zola Budd had somehow been given preferential treatment in getting this passport in order to compete for Britain, and this is also what sort of fueled the flames of those who were already angry with her or angry with the country where she was born.
Yeah, the Daily Mail had great political contacts with the Thatcher administration. But you think about this. This is a 17-year-old. She's not even old enough to vote. She didn't even know who Nelson Mandela was. Did not know. And her first language was not English. She was very shy, very reticent. She was 17 years old chronologically, but socially probably 13 or 14. Her room was full of Raggedy Ann dolls and so forth, and she had led virtually a sheltered life. But this girl comes to Great Britain. They use their political contacts to rush her citizenship through in a matter of days when everybody else would have to wait years. And then she becomes the subject of parliamentary debate. This is unbelievable to me. I mean, here they are debating about a 17-year-old kid in parliament while the whole country is undergoing the deprivation of a coal miner's strike. She's the biggest story in Great Britain for 4 or 5 months in a row, and she remains a major story in Great Britain for the next 4 years, 4 or 5 years.
Right. And, of course, what probably even heightens the attention that she is given is the fact that she is also a relatively small woman, particularly in comparison to some of her competitors, and she ran barefoot. And so, you know, there was no way to, in a sense, for her to lose herself in a crowd. I mean, you immediately knew that's Zola Budd, and there was something, in a sense, a bit innocent-looking or almost even primitive-looking about this small woman running barefoot in the midst of these other athletes.
Yeah, I think that's a large part of her appeal, and you've characterized her correctly. She was very innocent, had no clue that this was going to happen to her. Her father literally sold her out, and he saw her as more of a commodity than his daughter. Mm. And that would lead to the estrangement of the two of them, and it was very unfortunate. Zola went through Zola went through bedlam. I mean, you just can't imagine that. And I don't, as you said, I became very respectful of her as I learned what she had endured.
Right.
And I, for the life of me, cannot understand, and I've told her this, I said, I don't know how you possibly survived it, but she
right.
did.
It really is incredible.
Yeah.
I do want to say something else I really found fascinating in your book, and more so than I sort of expected, was I knew something of the checkered competitive career of Mary Decker, the fact that she was at certain points in time the finest female runner in the world.
Yes.
But then would suffer again and again these debilitating injuries. And mm-hmm. and I came to really sympathize with an athlete who would reach the absolute pinnacle of their sport.
Mm-hmm.
And not just once, but again and again.
Oh, yeah.
And again. And yet, again and again, have her own body betray her. That's
yes.
that is a traumatic kind of suffering all its own.
Well, yeah, and I think that Mary's perseverance in the face of it, you know, she had 30 surgeries throughout her career. She had more comebacks than Cher. I mean, this woman's running career was an alternating tapestry of triumph and tragedy. And what you find in the book is that most of her physical problems, most of them, came because Mary always had to be first. Even if she was in a practice run with her coach on an off day, she had to be first. And she would get injured, and instead of healing and doing what her coaches instructed her to do, she would be out there on the track running injured, and of course she would get hurt again. She would miss a year, then she would come back, she would run great, then she would get hurt again. I mean, these two, it was a soap opera, and that made her appealing. She had started as a little pigtailed runner with braces and ended up the greatest runner in the world when she was healthy.
Right. And another thing I found quite distinctive about her story is that she herself called herself a has-been at 16.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as a very young teenager, she enjoyed this phenomenal success. And then as her body matured, she began to run into trouble, coupled with serious trouble at home between her parents, and there was the very real possibility that, in a sense, all of this would be over before it ever really began. And to me, that's one of the most striking things about her story, is the fact that she was able to come back from such serious reversals at the tender age of 15, mm-hmm. 16, mm-hmm. 17. I mean, there aren't a lot of athletes that manage to do that.
No, and I think you asked me earlier about the way I depict Mary and the way I depict Zola, but both of these women, I think readers will be inspired and informed by the stories of both of these women. They're both incredibly, spectacularly talented women who had to overcome so much in their lives to get where they got, and then I think that the Mary's perseverance and Zola's resilience are the two things that people will take away from them. Now, the difference is that Mary had the advantage of being managed by International Management Group, which was Mark McCormick's company, and Nike. And her image was carefully manufactured and carefully nurtured, and so in our minds we thought we knew who Mary Decker really was, and it turns out that she wasn't quite what we thought she was, and that did not become apparent until after the race in the Olympics, when she held the press conference and accused Zola Budd. And I'll tell you a funny story. I was interviewing Rick Riley, who was a writer at the time for the Los Angeles Times. And I was talking to him on the telephone, and I said, well, you know, Rick, Mary Decker was America's sweetheart, and he interrupted me. And he said, if Mary Decker was America's sweetheart, America needed body armor. And yet, so it's one of the great lines of the book, and I didn't write it. So, but the thing is that this is not the Mary Decker that was presented to the public.
Right.
Okay?
And
with Zola, it's just the opposite. Zola, Bud, was this symbol of apartheid, with a target on her back, booed wherever she went, picketed, spat upon, called names, debated about in Parliament, named a known racist by the United Nations, and here she is, this as you said, totally innocent young woman who just wants to run.
Right.
That's all she wanted to do.
In a sense, this is a cautionary tale about myth making, or the assignment of simplistic labels, and that is certainly true in terms of both of these runners. Just a quick word about the collision itself at the 1984 Olympics in this 3,000 meter race. I appreciate the care with which you tell this story, and we also hear from other runners in the race, including the Romanian runner who actually ended up winning the race.
Right.
You also spoke to the ABC announcer, mm-hmm. who had the graciousness to, in a sense, call into question his initial impression of what happened in that race and why. And, of course, his initial impression is what everybody remembers,
right,
because it was broadcast to millions and millions of people watching on television. Just say a quick word about that.
Yeah, well, Marty Licori was a great runner himself. He was the ABC analyst for the race, and Marty had been a world record holder at Villanova University. So as the incident occurs, Mary runs into Zola not once but twice, the second time falling to the infield and laying there. Now, she's prostrate on the infield, and the television cameras are trained on Mary Decker in the infield, not on the race itself. I mean, this is unbelievable stuff. And Marty has his director screaming in his ear, trying to you know, tell us what happened. And Marty makes an instantaneous analysis of what he thought he saw from way up in the press booth. And to his credit, I have to tell you this, to his credit, he went back to his room, watched the video again and again of that race, and the next day, of course, no one was watching the next day, but the next day he apologized and said he had been wrong. It was no one's fault. It was just simply an accident that occurs during racing. And but we don't remember that. We remember the press conference Mary held and the accusations she made. And one of the people that may be of interest to you that I interviewed in that race was the woman that finished in the worst place you can finish in the Olympics, in fourth place, and that was Cindy Bremser.
Yes.
Cindy grew up in Wisconsin. She was from she actually born and raised near Milwaukee and then moved to, I think, Manitowoc, is it?
Manitowoc. Yep.
And ran for the University of Wisconsin. She was a great runner. But she was ignored. All these women. I profiled all the other women in the race because I just thought it was so unfair to these women. They were totally ignored. Everybody was focused on Mary Decker versus Zola Budd.
It's like there was nobody else in the race.
Exactly.
And, of course, that's one. It was commendable for Bud Greenspan when he made his documentary film about those 84 Olympics that one of the Olympians he chose to focus upon was Marina Puica from Romania. And, of course, that was a dramatic story because Romania was essentially the only country that defied sort of the communist bloc and came to Los Angeles to compete. And those Romanian athletes were welcomed very, very warmly. And, of course, she ends up scoring gold for her country.
Yeah, and the other problem with Marisica Poica is that she was surrounded by the security forces of the Romanian government. She couldn't speak English, so she was not a great story. But if you looked at the times of the women in the race, objectively, if you did that, you would see that Joyka was the clear favorite, not Mary Decker, certainly not Zola Budd, who had no international experience whatsoever. And yet you never heard Joyka's name until after the race was over, and she was practically ignored then because they were concentrating on Mary Decker's fall and the press conference that was held. Zola Budd had to be spirited away from the Olympics with police escort. There were death threats against Zola Budd. But Joyka would have been the favorite if we had been objective about it.
Right. Of course, there was very little objectivity at that moment in time. Well, your book, of course, goes on to talk about the aftermath of the race, including a couple of different races in which Mary Decker and Zola Budd ran against each other, with Mary Decker always coming out on top. Mm-hmm. And of course, also some other ways in which their own stories become a bit tangled in controversies of one kind or another. We'll leave it to our listeners to explore your book and explore those particular stories. Just say a word about the limited extent, you've already touched on it, the limited extent to which these two athletes began to at least sort of nod towards each other after the catastrophe of 1984. Now, I don't mean to imply that there's ever been some sort of joyful reunion and hugs and cheers, but just the way in which they have each come to terms with what happened in 1984.
Well, it's interesting. There's a film, a documentary film called The Fall, which was produced by an Academy Award-winning producer and an Emmy Award-winning director, and it was shown in Great Britain at the end of July. It's called The Fall, and they actually brought together Zola Budd and Mary Decker for the first time at the Los Angeles Coliseum since the 1984 games. And I was asked to appear in the film and did so. But what you find is that the two women have very different memories, very different reactions. Mary Decker admits that she never really moved on from that moment in her career when she fell to the infield. She thinks about it every single day, and it'll always haunt her. Zola Budd, on the other hand, is at peace. She said she'll tell you. It's like it happened to somebody else, and she still runs. She's winning races, long races, ultra marathons and marathons, and she's 50 years old, and she's an assistant track coach at Coastal Carolina University in Conway, South Carolina. But it's interesting in learning the way they've handled the trauma of that moment in time that has forever joined them and will forever join them.
Hmm. That is really the heart and soul of this fascinating story and your marvelous book, again called Olympic Collision, The Story of Mary Decker and Zola Budd, published by the University of Nebraska Press, the author Kyle Keiterling. Kyle Keiterling, this was no easy task, and I commend you for telling this complicated story so thoroughly and so fairly. And I appreciate you joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Best wishes to you.
Thank you, Greg. Nice to be with you.
Part two of The Morning Show coming up in just a moment here on WGTD.
For part two of today's morning show, we want to talk about several different things that are going on this weekend that you might enjoy seeing, and then we'll talk about one of them in particular. First of all, this weekend, a production opened last night, and the performance is tonight and tomorrow night as well, at Mahone Middle School, of the lovely musical Once on This Island. And I've heard only rave reports about this production, which features some of Kenosha Unified's most talented middle school students. One of the great masterworks of American theater, Death of a Salesman, is currently being performed at the Rhodey Opera House in downtown Kenosha as part of the current season of the Lakeside Players. You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown is being presented by the Children's Theater Academy down at Armitage Academy. And Sunday afternoon, there is a performance that I have a hand in at First United Methodist Church as part of their series called Fine Arts at First. We're going to take a few minutes to talk about that with Jessica DeBoer, who is the coordinator, or what is your grand poobah title?
Director, I believe that would be my title. Yeah, director.
Director of the Fine Arts at First series at First United Methodist, which is at the corner of Sheridan Road and 60th Street. And, of course, probably a whole lot of our listeners have taken in at least something as part of that series, which has been around a long time and which has presented kind of an amazing array of things over the years. For somebody who is unfamiliar with Fine Arts at First, just sketch the length and breadth of what gets offered.
Sure. We started, this is our 12th season, and we started our presenting concerts to the community because we had been given a gift, and that gift is our grand piano that's in our sanctuary, and it is a beautiful concert grand Bursendorfer piano, and I think it's the only Bursendorfer in the area. So
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, it's fantastic, and so we wanted to share that gift with the community, and we do that by presenting free concerts. We have everything from solo piano to small chamber groups to opera programs, violin and piano. I mean, we have tons of different things every season, and we really pride ourselves on having a wide variety, but also that all of our programs are free.
And it must be sort of a delightful challenge and to get to decide from a whole realm of possibilities what your actual season will consist of.
Every year I have a huge list, and I have to pick programs that will create variety, but also programs that will fit into our time, you know, into our schedule and with the performer schedule. So a lot of times groups just can't make it because we can't fit them in with their schedule. So sometimes it works out well. Other times it's hard to pare it down. Other times you just can't find someone to fill a spot. And so it's always a challenge in many different ways.
Right. Well, for some reason, you've decided
to
have me sing a program this Sunday afternoon at 3 o'clock devoted to the wonderful world of love songs. So,
yes.
Is there anything you want to know?
Well, here we go. Time to interview Greg, right? Turning the tables.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I was thinking about love songs, and I thought, you know, there's love songs, you know, oh, I love you, I love you. But then there's love songs that are, you know, parent and child relationship love. There are love songs about things that you love, you know, I love my car, or I love ice cream, or whatever. You know, there's got to be love songs devoted to things. And there's also the pain of love, you know, lost love, or, you know, unrequited love. And so how do you even begin to decide what, so how, I mean, and there's thousands, tens of thousands of love songs,
really
hundreds
are.
Of thousands of love songs over all of the centuries of music. How do you even begin to pick? I mean, clearly there are songs you like the best, but how, I mean, I don't even, that is such a daunting challenge to me.
Right. Well, it's also this incredible opportunity because, like you just said, there's a treasure trove out there waiting to be explored. It's probably, if you can group anything together, as more songs have been written about this than
mm-hmm.
anything else, it would be this. And and you really touched on something that's especially important to me, which is the fact that even if you just take it down to
kind of relationship love,
mm-hmm.
Where you are in love with somebody. Even that itself, even if you limit yourself to that, can take on so many different flavors.
Absolutely.
Because it can be kind of a time-worn love over many, many, many years, or it can be puppy love. Or
new love,
or,
yep.
Yeah, I mean, head over heels and love at first sight. And you touched on unrequited love, or sometimes love that sometimes carries with it terrible, terrible pain, sometimes
sure.
love that turns into, you know, kind of obsession. And these are all things that in various ways over the centuries, various poets and writers and composers have been fascinated by. So I guess that's probably one of the first things I'd say is that although mostly this will be a concert that's full of music that kind of makes you smile, there will certainly be some moments, too, in which we also kind of explore sort of the darker sides of what love sometimes means in people's lives.
And amazing that those types of loves have been written about across all the centuries. I mean, we're going to hear music on Sunday from the Baroque, from Broadway. You know, I think it's going to be an amazing array of songs.
Right. By my calculations, we'll span about 400 years
of music
history, which is kind of cool. And I think when you start thinking about that, you realize that for all the ways in which we've changed, there are a whole lot of ways also in which human beings have not changed all that much. I mean, we still have a lot of the same hungers and desires and joys and sorrows that we did before the pilgrims landed. I mean, way before that even. So it's fun to think about a program that envelops all of that. Not that it encompasses it all completely, but just gives a hint of
sure.
all that's out there.
Scratches the surface.
I know that one of the songs I'm going to be singing on Sunday has kind of special personal meaning
yeah.
for you. So
right.
Tell our listeners about that.
Sure. A couple weeks ago I emailed you and said, hey, can I get the program? And you said, well, I'm still hashing out the last few pieces. And I said, well, if you're taking requests, would you sing Widmung, which is a German Lied by the composer Robert Schumann. I'd heard you sing it before a couple years ago, and so I know that it's in your repertoire, and I thought that would be lovely to hear because it was sung at my wedding. My husband and I got married over 15 years ago, and a lovely friend of ours from college, who's a soprano actually, sang that at our wedding. So I put in my two cents, and look, it's on the program.
And this is one of the all-time great love songs, and it's got a great love story behind it.
Mm-hmm.
It was written as essentially a wedding present by Robert Schumann for his young bride, Clara. They'd had to wait years and years and years before they could finally get married because her father was adamantly opposed. And when finally, by a court edict, he was finally forced to desist or whatever they want to say and allow the marriage to go ahead. And they were so relieved. And Robert presented Clara with this wonderful song, and the words are about you are my joy, you are my sorrow, you are my heaven in which I ascend, you are my grave into which I pour all my sorrows, you are my rest, you make me better, you like
it's lovely.
Just
and perfect for a wedding,
it
know?
Really, really is. So just to give people a taste of it, here is the great baritone Thomas Quasthoff singing this great song by Robert Schumann called Widmung. The word means dedication. This is one of the songs I'll sing on Sunday afternoon.
Du meine Seele, du mein Herz, du meine Wonne, du mein Schmerz, du meine Welt, in dir ich lebe, mein Himmel, du allein ich schwebe, du mein Brat, was ich ewig meinen Kummer gab. Du bist die Ruh, du bist der Frieden, du bist vom macht mich mir fehlt, dein Blick hat mich vor mir verklärt. Du hebst mich, liebet über mich.
Robert Schumann's great masterwork of Widmung. It's one of the songs that I'll be singing on this concert coming up Sunday afternoon. It's not all classical, by the way. Actually, it's probably not even quite half and half, but maybe roughly half and half classical things in a variety of languages and over quite a wide span of time. And then lots of musical theater, mm-hmm. and even a couple of things that we might call more sort of pop songs, that kind of thing. Some Rodgers and Hammerstein, some Leonard and Lowe, some Stephen Sondheim, even a little bit of James Taylor. So it's going to be a nice wide range of various love songs. So
that's great. And so the program also says Greg Berg and friends. So tell us about your friends, Greg.
Yeah, I have
a couple friends. Oh, well, everybody has friends, right? I'm sure your friends are awfully musical.
Well, most of them are. So what's going to happen is I'll be really happy to share the stage with some people important to me, and probably I should begin with my wife, Kathy. She and I celebrated our 25th wedding anniversary in September.
Congrats.
Thank you. And so that's why my faculty recital in September was devoted to love songs, and why I've kind of been thinking about them in a different way.
Since you just said that, will this be the same recital that you did?
No, it's different.
If people came to the one in September, they'll hear new things on this one.
Yeah, hear a lot of different things. There'll be a few things that are the same, including a couple of duets that Kathy and I sang on that recital, and at least one thing that we didn't before. But so Kathy will join us.
But since you mentioned that,
I wanted to bring that up. And Kathy's best friend, Kate Potter Barrow, and the three of us love singing together, and we're going to be singing, among other things, "Not While I'm Around" from Sweeney
that's
Todd
such a
by
wonderful
Stephen Sondheim.
Song.
Yeah, and that those words have kind of special meaning, because one of the most loving things you can do for someone is to make sure that they're safe, and that's what this that's what the song is all about. And it really got us thinking about you know, some of the people among us who are feeling sort of scared or bewildered right now.
Sure.
And that's another way, important way to reach out in love to other people. And then I'm really also excited to invite some of my very finest voice students to be part of this too. Several of my best students at Carthage. Carthage is on break this weekend for Thanksgiving, but these three students all happen to be fairly close by, Burlington and Waukesha and Racine. So excited to have them. And a couple of my seniors who are high school voice students, private students of mine, who are very, very good and will offer up some musical theater stuff. And one of my students at Carthage, who's just a freshman, the others are upperclassmen, but a freshman who happens to be a member of your church.
Chris Wojciechowicz.
Yeah. So he's going to be singing and playing a little flute, too. So I'm excited
to
have
him. He does both very well.
Yeah. So it's going to be all of that and more Sunday afternoon. And you should probably say the particulars about where people go and how much they have to pay.
Pay nothing. It is all free, which is so wonderful. It will take place at 3 o'clock, First United Methodist Church. That's on the corner of Sheridan and 60th. I always tell people we're the church with the big flashy sign, and they know exactly which one that is. We've got that large sign out there. But we're on the southwest corner of Sheridan and 60th. The doors will open to the sanctuary at 2:30, so you can come but beforehand there'll be a place to sit, and it's absolutely free. There's no tickets. There's no admission. We do ask for a free will offering to help defray the costs and to help keep us in business. And so we always appreciate that. But otherwise, it's completely free, and just come on in and enjoy a fabulous afternoon of love songs.
Absolutely. And I look forward to doing that, and I'm honored to have been asked. And then, of course, coming up in December will be the Sing-Along Messiah.
That's
on
right.
Sunday night, December 18th.
So, yep, we'll look forward to that, too.
Lots to look forward to.